Well, good morning. We're in Mark and we're in chapter 5. Today we're going to be studying the passage where Jesus is going to encounter Jairus, who has a very sick daughter. And on the way to see Jairus' daughter, Jesus also encounters a woman who has been ill for some time and has bleeding. And this comes in a series of passages which are telling us about who Jesus is. We remember Jesus calms the storm. We saw that, who is this Jesus? Well, he's the kind of person who has power over the wind and the waves. Makes sense. He created the wind and the waves. Of course, he would have power to calm them down. If he made them, he certainly can control them. But this is shocking. How can any man control the wind and the waves? Well, the point is, any man couldn't, but God could. And that's the point that we're trying to understand, that Jesus is God. But we saw last week that not only does Jesus have control over natural creation, he also has control over the powers of hell. Here we're encountered with Legion, a terrible demon, a multi-demon of sorts, thousands in number. This poor man afflicted in the most terrible way by it. And yet, it's no problem for Jesus to overcome this demon. He has power over the creation that he himself made. He has power over the dominions of hell because he created them as well. And now we see that he also has power over sickness and even power over death, which is especially significant for us. And so we start in here. And one thing that we see right at the get-go of this passage is that we're faced with the question of, should this be two separate messages? Should this be two separate accounts, as it were? We have the account of Jairus and the account of the sick woman. And we see them integrated together. And some have suggested, well, these are two separate accounts. They happened at two separate times. And Mark has just woven them together because this is what gospel authors do. They think topically and they weave things together. But I don't think so. I mean, if you're asking me personally. I agree that the gospels are topical. I agree that Mark has gone to the trouble of organizing the material in a coherent and cognitive way so that we can walk through this narrative. That it's very intentional how he placed passages where he did, how he placed counts where he did. But I do not think that Mark would, how should you say, embed a story within a story when those stories really didn't actually happen in time and space together. Because that's taking it one step too far. We see that while Jesus is on the way to see Jairus, the woman comes to him while he's on the way there. And that's important for the whole passage as a whole. So this was not, in my mind, originally two separate things that happened at two separate times, it was indeed one event. And that's what God's Word communicates to us, and that's how I think it's best to understand it. So we're going to try our best to work through this, and we see right at the beginning of the passage, we're in chapter 5, verse 21, that when Jesus had crossed over by boat to the other side of the lake, a large crowd was gathered around him while he was by the lake. And you can see this picture up here, and if you can recall, last week he had sort of left this area, which was probably Capernaum, somewhere on the north side of the shore, and then he traveled to, like I said, we're not exactly sure where, but a lot of people had thought it was Gadara down in the bottom right here, but that's just too far inland, it seems, so perhaps it was somewhere over there on your right side of the lake. It may not be that he traveled the whole way over to the south side, but he sort of came across to the right side of the lake. And remember when he cured the man of Legion, everybody was terrified and they wanted to leave. They didn't want their animals running like crazy off the cliff. But Jesus left the man that was cured there to spread the gospel message. He didn't let him come with him. He got back in the boat and he left. And now he's come back to probably the north shore. I would guess Capernaum, but probably the north shore somewhere. He's gotten out of the boat, and here, the people are not afraid of him. There's a large group of people that are ready for him and waiting for him. Jesus is back. Excellent. And they are excited to see him. And as he gets off of the boat, as he gets out of the boat and he heads into this more densely populated area, we see that one of the synagogue rulers named Jairus came there. And while our parallel gospel account, Matthew, doesn't mention the name Jairus, Luke does mention the name Jairus. Mark here mentions it. I would suggest that it is historical, and the textual witnesses to the name are strong enough to say that it should be there. The synagogue ruler named Jairus came there, seeing Jesus. He fell at his feet and pleaded earnestly with him, saying, "My little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and lived." And so Jesus went with him. A large crowd followed and pressed around him. Now, a couple things we want to note by this. What is a synagogue ruler exactly? Well, as you know, they had synagogues, which were basically like church buildings, for lack of better words. You recall I put one up there a little while back, just stone pillars along the sides. It was a gathering place for the reading and instruction of the word. And synagogue rulers were not rabbi, but they were lay folk that had a higher position. They were in charge of the functioning and the organization of the synagogue. And so this was a more notable person. And he comes up and he sees that Jesus is there, and he runs up to him. He falls at his knees and he begs with him for his daughter's behalf. And it's interesting because, being a synagogue ruler, we know that he is a Jew. He's not a Gentile. He's a Jew. And so it gives us insight that not all Jews are opposed to the ministry and teaching of Jesus. And I think this is important to note. Even when Jesus is being crucified, later on, we see some Pharisees who are willing to accept what they see. Not everybody is holistically rejecting Jesus. And here is one particular Jew who goes and pleads with him. I can sympathize with this. I mean, it says that it was his only daughter, and I do have two daughters, but I can't imagine how it would be to see your daughter dying and just being completely hopeless, and to watch her. And we wonder, how is she? Is she in the ICU? Is she in critical condition? Well, the word that's actually used there is for dying is actually eschatos, eschatos. It comes from the word, you recall, eschatology, last things. It's the word for last. It doesn't actually say that she's dying in the Greek. It says that she's at her last, literally. In other words, she's at the brink of death. She is all but dead. In fact, I believe it's the account in Matthew that actually says that she was already dead. And so she's either very close to being dead, or she is, in fact, just at the very, very brink of death. And as a last resort, perhaps this man Jairus hears that Jesus' boat is coming in, and he rushes to the shore. And when Jesus gets out and there's a crowd of people, he forces his way through. All he can think about is his daughter. He bows down before him. He begs him, "Please come and help me." And Jesus is compassionate. He goes with him, which is interesting because what we see, one of the things we see in this passage is, who does Jesus care about? Does he only care about religious dignitaries? No, he cares even for the least of these. He cares for a young daughter, and he cares for a woman who is on the fringes of society. But one thing we need to note before we move on here, verse 24, did you see what I put in parentheses there? Jesus goes with them. A large crowd follows and presses around him. Luke says, literally, that they almost crushed him. So you need to picture this with me in your mind's eye. Jesus is walking along with Jairus, and there is a crowd literally thronging him, or that is, pressing him against him, crushing him. And Jesus is coming along, and there's just craziness. Just imagine people just pushing in. Have you ever seen, on the news, when somebody's trying to push through and the bodyguards are there kind of pushing the people off and he's trying to get through? It's like that, only I don't know how much Jesus' disciples are acting like bodyguards for him. And they're almost crushing him. So Jesus is trying to get to Jairus' house, smushing through this massive amount of people that are just pressing in on him. Hysteria is rising because, you know, Jairus' daughter is probably not the only one who's sick and in need of health, and people want to get to Jesus. They want to be healed by him. And one woman in particular has this in mind as well. And we see here, in starting in verse 25, and a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years. And she had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all she had. Yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. Take a moment with me to consider this woman's condition. She had been bleeding for 12 years. We don't know if this was a perpetual menstrual strike or a hemorrhage of some kind, but you know, just imagine what that would be like back in their day. You know, you can't go to Walmart and get the sanitary things that you can get today. To perpetually have to deal with that, especially if you're a woman, you can sympathize with what she was going through. And so she had this bleeding, and it was going on for 12 years. It's interesting that the daughter is 12, and it was going on for 12 years. There may be no implication there at all, but I think it's one of those little things that Mark actually has done just to help us see that the passage is indeed meant to be connected, and it's not meant to be seen as separate passages. But in any case, she's been bleeding for some time. She had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors, and she had spent all she had. So she had gone to these doctors, and I don't think these doctors didn't want to heal her, but they couldn't heal her. Her condition was beyond their medicine. It was beyond their expertise. And you can imagine, in this pre-scientific time that they were in, what sort of measures they might have gone to try to heal her. And you have to, I'm not trying to be gross, but you have to think of where the problem is occurring and what might have taken place to try to bring healing and just the sensitivity of all that. And you can just experience her pain that she went through as she was under the care of all these physicians. She had spent all her money. She was destitute. She was bleeding. She was in pain. That it wasn't helping. All that happened as she gave everything she had to try to find a cure is that she only got worse. And there's even something else. When we consider her bleeding, it's not just that she's in pain. It's not just that she's broke. It's not just that, you know, she has to deal with this terrible ailment. It's also the situation that results from the old covenant law that she's trying to live under. And as you recall, Leviticus has specific instructions for this particular matter. We see it in Leviticus 15, verses 25 and 27. When a woman has a discharge of blood for many days at a time, other than her monthly period, or has a discharge that continues beyond her period, she will be unclean as long as she has the discharge, just as in the days of her period. Any bed she lies on while her discharge continues will be unclean, as is her bed during her monthly period. And anything she sits on will be unclean, as during her period. Whoever touches them will be unclean. He must wash his clothes and bathe with water, and he will be unclean till evening. Now you put all this together, and what does it mean for this woman? For well over a decade, she was unclean. She couldn't touch anyone else. She couldn't get near anyone else. People couldn't even be around her because everything she touched, everything she sat on, everything she got near, all that stuff was unclean. She was essentially an outcast from society. As bad as a leper, really. Nobody could get near her. Nobody could get near anything she touched. I feel for this woman. I feel for her. Her situation is quite terrible. We see in verse 27 that when she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak because she thought, if I just touch his clothes, I will be healed. Immediately, her bleeding stopped and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. It might be prudent for us to just think about what's going on here. Some have suggested that perhaps her faith in Christ wasn't entirely sincere because it was common practice or common thought back then that if you could touch a holy person, that it would bring healing. And so perhaps she's riding off of this superstition, but I'm not so sure that that's primarily the case. I think she's heard the testimony of what Jesus did. I think she's seen the power that was there. She believes it. I think there is something within her that truly believes that Jesus is the Messiah, that he has this power, and she knows. She doesn't even need to touch him. Her faith is such that if she can just get near him, if she could even just touch his clothes, that his power would be great enough, that perhaps that could bring healing. And you have to understand what's going through her mind too, because remember Jesus' situation? As he's walking to Jairus' house, What did we read was happening to him? He was being crushed almost by the people. And so what does this woman have to do in order to try and get to his clothes? She has to push in through the crowd. She has to push in through the people into the crowd so that she can reach out and get a hand on a piece of his clothing as he walks by. And in pushing into the people, what is she doing? Breaking the law. Because she knows she's unclean. And all those people that she's brushing up against and pushing around to try and get to Jesus, technically, according to the ceremonial law, she's making them unclean as well. But she does this. She gets her way through. She's desperate. Her eyes are on Jesus. It's not on the regulations at this point. She may have an idea of that this is indeed the Messiah. It may be part of her belief. But she pushes in through and she gets to Jesus and she touches him, and immediately it works. Her bleeding stops and she knows it. She feels in her body right away that she's freed from her suffering. You say, how can she feel right away? Well, I think her situation was such that she had a constant pain. I think this is another detail that tells us about this poor woman's condition. She, every time she took a step, every time she walked, every time she took a breath, every time she sat up, every time she got down, there was twinges of sharp pain. Whatever was going on in her was severe. And it was a constant reminder that something was terribly wrong. And as she touches Jesus, all of a sudden, boom. Instantly those things turn off. And she feels that healing has taken place. Well, now this is where things start to really get interesting. Mark chapter 5, verse 30. Immediately Jesus, perceiving in himself the power proceeding from him had gone forth, turned around in the crowd and said, "Who touched my garments?" The disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing in on you, crushing you, and you say, 'Who touched me?'" And he looked around to see the woman who had done this. Now, this is a very interesting part of the story because of this passage, some folks have seemed to have questioned the omniscience of Jesus. The omniscience is the word for all-knowing, that he was all-knowing. I think we need to think about this for a moment. Does this passage convey the idea that Jesus, in his humanness, as it were, didn't know who had touched him? Of course, there are parallel passages of things, and some commentators who I know that you perhaps love and respect, have literally said Jesus is not omniscient in all things. Well, consider the passage about the Father and the end of times. You know, when will the judgment come? It's not for the Son to know, only for the Father. But I don't really see passages like that one about the coming of the future judgment to be an explanation of Jesus not being omniscient. I think that what you see there is a perfect unity in the Trinity. I think you see that it is within the role of the Father to know that time, and the Son has willfully given that role to the Father. I actually think that this passage doesn't show that Jesus doesn't know all things, but actually shows that he does know precisely what's going on. I don't think he's walking along not knowing this woman. I think he's actually aware of what's about to happen. I mean, what is it that heals this woman? Is it just the idea? If you just have random faith in anything, can anything happen? No, the healing always comes from who? The healing always comes from God. God is the only one who can do these miracles. That's why they're amazing. That's why they're outstanding. That's why they point to the fact that Jesus Christ is indeed God. And so the healing comes from God. And God is not ignorant of this situation. Some have suggested, well, the Father in heaven is the one who healed her, and the Son becomes aware of that but didn't know that. But I don't think so. She touches him, and the text says that immediately Jesus knows that it had happened. The wording might be a little funny, perceiving in himself that power proceeding from him had gone forth. And I'm deviating from my typical translation here. I'm using the NASB 1995 update because I think that's the one in this particular case that does the most justice to the Greek that's behind it. But basically, the text is trying to say that when he's touched, immediately Jesus flies around because he knows that the deed has happened. And he asked, "Who touched my garments?" Not because he doesn't know who touched his garments, but because he wants to call out the person who did it. It's not his way of saying, "Hey, I don't know who it was, but somebody here touched me." It's his way of saying, "You who touched me, stand up and show yourself." He wants to call the woman out. His disciples think this is craziness. They say, "Everybody's pushing in around you." In fact, this is a very unique situation just to Mark. The other, Matthew and Luke, they downplay the gospel's comments. But Mark is actually very poignant here. He paints the disciples in a more bad light. At this point, they're not doing too good. The disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing in around you? And you say, 'You touch me?'" And Jesus ignores them. And look what he says next. Depending which translation you use, it may not say the woman, but the Greek clearly has the woman. He looked around to see the woman who had done this. He wasn't just surrounded by women, he was surrounded by men and women. Why would he turn around to see the woman who had done this if he didn't know it was a woman? You see what I'm saying? He knew that it was a woman, and he didn't just know that it was a woman, he knew exactly who the woman was. And so the text here is not... It's not calling into question Jesus' omniscience. I think it's actually highlighting the fact that Jesus is omniscient. God is the one who heals her. Jesus is God. He knows that the healing happens. Right when the miracle is done, he turns around to call out the woman. Well, how would you feel if you were that woman at this point? All of a sudden, everybody was pushing in. Jesus stops. Everybody's like, "Whoa, whoa, whoa." And he's like, "Who touched me?" And the disciples are like, "Whoa, dude, relax. Everyone was touching you." "No, no, no. Who touched me?" And here's this woman. She had just been miraculously healed. She's probably trying to back up. And he's looking right at her, I'm betting. She knows she's caught. What's going through her mind? "I'm unclean. Now I've made this holy man unclean. He's going to berate me. I touched him. I didn't ask permission. I'm just a woman. What's gonna go down? I'm sure she's full of lots of thoughts along those lines. It says in verse 33, "Then the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet, and trembling with fear, told him the whole truth." I'm sure she started crying, "Jesus, I'm so sorry. For 12 years, I've been bleeding and I spent all my money and I'm living on the streets and I have nothing left and I'm an outcast and I can't go near anybody and I heard that you were doing miracles and I was desperate. I was at my last end. I had nowhere else to go to. I had nothing else to do and I know I was unclean and I'm so sorry." And in the midst of her sobbing and her tears, she's recounting all this to him. "If you can ever please forgive me, I didn't know what else to do. I didn't have anywhere else to go." She's telling him the whole truth. She's laying it out. And he doesn't say, "How dare you?" He doesn't say, "You know, you should have asked." He doesn't say anything. He doesn't correct her in any way. The fact that she was ceremonially unclean is absolutely insignificant to Christ. In fact, he's going to go touch a dead person. That would make you unclean too. He doesn't care about that either. If you recall, we went through the passage where David goes in and he takes the showbread and even though it's ungood to eat that in that way, the priest gives it to David and to his men. And the whole point is that God cares about the actual people. Jesus said, "Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice." The same is held in here. And so he says to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Daughter, your faith has healed you." Is that what your translation says? It says that it's healed you. Does anyone have save you? Your faith has saved you? I don't know why not. I mean, if you look up the Greek here, the word is zozo. That's the word for saved. I mean, in this particular context, it's in a different tense. Sesosken. But it's the word for saved. And it can mean healing in a sense, but I think that Jesus is trying to communicate something theological here. Yes, she's been healed. But it's not even the healing that Jesus cares about at this moment. It's her salvation. He says, your faith has saved you. We need to think about this. Justification is by faith, of course. Think about unity for 1 second. You say, why are we talking about unity? Well, I'm just trying to draw an analogy here. Is unity in and of itself a good thing? Well, it could be or it couldn't be. It depends what it's based on, right? Hitler, Germany was unified. That doesn't mean that unity was a good thing. Churches may be unified, but if they're unified around something heretical or something wrong, that's not a good thing. Unity is a good thing when it's based on unity in Christ and unity in the Word of God. Faith in and of itself has no empirical power. A Muslim or somebody from a Islamic country who's a suicide bomber, as we often see, they may have faith that if they blow themselves up, that they'll go to heaven for such an act. But just because they have faith in that act doesn't mean that that's what really happens. A faith in God is what's important, faith in Jesus Christ. And it wasn't her faith in and of herself, it was the fact that she had placed her faith in Jesus. Faith is the instrument that God uses to connect us to Himself. We're justified by faith, and here there's an inkling of a foreshadowing of what Jesus is going to do. Daughter, your faith has healed you. Your faith in me, the one and only true God, has healed you. And he tells her to go in peace, not in fear, to go in peace and to be freed from her suffering. He assures her that she can go in peace, and he assures her that her healing has been completed. It literally says that she's been saved from the scourge. Saved from the scourge. Go in peace, you're saved from the scourge. This is a fantastic thing because as people reach out to Jesus in their desperation, he doesn't turn them away, he doesn't mock them, he doesn't make an appeal about the regulations of the ceremonial law. When people come in desperation to Jesus and they believe and they trust in him, when they come to him in their brokenness and they throw themselves down at his feet, when they trust in him in faith, they find salvation and they find the peace that only Jesus Christ can give. But meanwhile, while Jesus is still speaking, while this interchange is happening, something interesting happens. Some men came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue ruler, and they give some news. Your daughter is dead. Whether or not she had already been dead and Jairus didn't know it, as Matthew says, she was already dead. Perhaps she was already dead. Jairus had left and then she had died and she was already dead. And by the time Jairus gets there, he doesn't realize it or whatever had happened. We know that she was at her very last breath, as it were. But in any case, Jairus was there trying to get Jesus to come, and people come and they give this earth-shattering news. It's too late. She's done. Why bother the teacher anymore? Don't read on. See, you read the word ignoring what they said. Just stop for a moment and think if you were Jairus. Put your shoes in Jairus' feet. You've come to Jesus. This is your last and only hope. You've come to him. He's coming with you. You're excited. God's following with you. He's coming to your house. He's going to see your daughter. Maybe, just maybe, she will be saved too. And then your associates, your family members come and they say, your daughter's gone. Don't bother to teach her. Don't waste his time. And your heart skips a beat. Oh no. He's not going to come with me. He's not going to come to my house anymore. It's too late. My daughter's already dead. These are the things that are going through your mind. But then, to your amazement, Jesus doesn't turn away and say, oh, she's already dead. Jesus is on your side. ignores the other people. He ignores all the other people. His focus is on you. Even in the midst of the impossible, even in the midst of all the naysayers in your life, your horror at the fact that it's too late is comforted by the fact that Jesus is with you and he doesn't think it's too late. Ignoring what they said, Jesus told the synagogue ruler, "Don't be afraid, just believe." I think this is one of the most fascinating parts of this whole passage, because when I put myself in that, in Jairus' shoes, I am just left with this unimaginable sadness. It's too late for my daughter. Everybody else says it's too late. Everybody else is against me. But then to my amazement, Jesus is still right there with me. In the face of the impossible, he's encouraging me and helping me on my way. I think sometimes our lives can be like that. We come against challenges, we come against hardships, and maybe the advice or the worldly wisdom of friends or even family or whatever it may be, or the television or a book you read or whatever it may be, it may seem like everything's against you, but you remember Jesus is all powerful. He's always with you. He's never going to leave or forsake you. I tell myself this truth all the time. God has not forgotten me. God has not forgotten me. God is still with me no matter what. And that's the truth that Jairus experiences in a most blessed way. God is still with him. He goes along with him. He did not let anyone follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brothers of James. And this is just simply to say there was an inner circle. Why is it that they just go in? It could be because they have faith. Maybe some of the other disciples are struggling with this. It could just be out of sensitivity for the situation. It could be a practicality of the fact that the room was small and not everybody could fit in. But we know that Peter, James, and John, they're the ones that are with him for the transfiguration. They're the ones that are with him when he's crying out at Gethsemane. There's definitely something about these three. And they go along. And when they came to the home of the synagogue ruler, there's such a commotion. There's people crying and wailing loudly. And I need to speed up, but I'll just say, I said to Holly the other day, I said, hey, back in Bible times, you would have been in great shape. Because in the Mishnah, Rabbi Judah said, this is 200 AD, so it's a little bit after the fact. But basically it says there that every time a person dies, even if the person is very poor, they still have to get two flutists and a female wailer. And so this person, being probably a little more well off, being a synagogue ruler, he has several wailers, maybe several flutists. Jesus comes up, there's wailing, there's crying, the professional wailers are carrying on, the flutists are playing, everybody's going on. And he went to them and he said, why is all this commotion and wailing? The child is not dead, but asleep. And they laughed at him. The professional mourners become professional mockers. Now, some have said, does Jesus know that the lady's just in coma, the girl's just comatose? Is it that she's not dead? And I think what we need to understand here is that this is a common euphemism, that is a word that's softer in meaning, that is used to, how should you say, protect those who are more sensitive to the situation. You know, when somebody has a funeral, you don't go up and say, oh, I see they kicked the bucket. You know, you're sensitive about it. You say they passed away. Or, you know, and in Thessalonians, as people are being persecuted and killed for their faith, there's a passage, there's several passages in there which we know that those who've fallen asleep, and it talks about those who had been killed, those who were dead, but it talks of them as fallen asleep. I think it's a euphemism here too. The child's not dead, but asleep. They laugh at him because they know that he's dead. They do this for a living. They go and play flutes at people's funerals. And they can see clearly that the person, that the daughter is dead. After he put them all out, he took the child's father, mother, and those three disciples who were with him. And he went into where the child was. He took her by the hand and he said to her, Talitha kum. And that's an Aramaic word. Mark does it four times. He uses it here. It's possible Jesus spoke in Aramaic. After the Babylonian exile, most of the Israelites began speaking in Aramaic, which was the common tongue of the people. They also would have known Greek, which was what we call the lingua franca, the major language. But the oral tradition was preserved in this case, Talitha kum. And actually, in the Greek, it says talitha kum, and then it says, which translates, which literally means, little girl, I say to you, get up. And immediately the girl stood up and walked around. She was 12 years old. At this, they were completely astonished. Who is this person? He has control over the winds and the waves. He has control over the powers of hell. He can heal this woman who we all know was horrible. She was the most wretched of women and an outcast of all outcasts. Just this horrible bleeding and just this horrible pain. He heals her. And now, this is truly unbelievable. He raises somebody from the dead. He has power even over death. Jesus is stacking up to be an amazing person, so amazing, in fact, that he's almighty, that he is, in fact, God. Interestingly, he gives strict orders not to tell anyone about this. Why does he tell them not to tell anyone about this? Well, we've been through this before. He's trying to manage the commotion. He's already being crushed to death halfway on the way to Jairus. If people find out that he raises somebody from the dead before he gets time to move on from there, it could be chaos. And the last little bit is not something we want to gloss over. He told them to give her something to eat. Why does she need something to eat? She's been raised from the dead, but she's still mortal. This isn't her resurrection body. It's her mortal body. This little girl would grow older, but one day she would die again. And right now she has physical need because she's still a mortal person. Her mortal body has been restored. It's not her resurrection body. So we come to the end of this fascinating account in the Gospel of Mark. Next week we shift gears and we'll look at the prophet without honor, a very interesting little teaching.